So, dear colleagues, we are right on time, and we can start with the next presentation by Jutta Brunet, and we switch to climate change and climate regime.
Thank you very much, Pierre, and also thank you, Samantha. It's been fascinating already, and I look forward to the rest of the conversations that we'll have. Well, when I was asked to contribute to the project, I immediately thought of the climate regime because it has changed over time, not just to adapt to an evolving crisis, but also to adapt to the challenges precisely of lawmaking around a collective action problem, so that's the object in my case, in a consent-based system. The challenges around consent in this context, of course, aren't unique to climate change, but I do think that it raises them and shows them off in a particularly pointed way. First of all, I think it's probably obvious to all of us at this point that climate change is a policy challenge that is exceedingly complex, meaning it's multifaceted. It has ecological, economic, technological, social, equity, justice dimensions. It's long-term, and it's constantly shifting, either in one of these facets or in all of them and how they interact. And add to the fact that it isn't just tinkering that is required, but it is actually tackling climate change requires nothing less than all countries and the people within countries changing the way they do pretty much everything they do, and in some cases perhaps not doing them anymore at all. We talked about that at lunch a bit. That necessarily entails decisions about burden sharing, especially, not just, but especially between North and South, meaning that global climate policy is also entangled in international law's difficult history, including, in particular, its colonial history. So agreeing on whether and how to share burdens, and here, actually, now that I have this wonderful PowerPoint, I neglected to put up the complexity, so you get a visualization of all the issues that are involved. So agreeing on how to share the burdens is difficult, not just at the international level, but also, I would say, that national climate politics is just as fraught. And that's probably why, or one reason why, international climate politics is so difficult, because if climate politics is contentious nationally, how can an international regime, the object of which is collective action, develop in a consent-based legal order? How do you get it off the ground? How do you ensure that all relevant actors are involved? And how do you ensure that the regime can evolve to keep pace with the challenge? You can actually only solve a puzzle with all the pieces. Now imagine 190 plus players, each holding a piece, and think of consent as a key piece to the puzzle, and it's very often the missing piece. Only a few players putting their piece in place is not enough, and so that takes me to the focus of my talk, which is in the context of a collective action challenge, consent doesn't just have an individual dimension, but it also has a collective dimension. This was already alluded to at various points so far. Now imagine doing this over and over again, sort of like a Russian doll puzzle in reverse. Once the players agree on the shape and color and the smallest doll has come together, it's time to layer on a bigger and more ambitious one, and so on and so on. And each new puzzle is only going to come together if enough players consent. At the center of these challenges, I would suggest, are precisely these individual and collective dimensions of a consent-based approach to international lawmaking, or in my case, treaty lawmaking. Consent, of course, in some ways is quintessentially individual. It determines whether and when an individual state is bound. But in the context of an international treaty regime, states' individual consent feeds into a collective process. The treaty can take effect and progress and evolve only if and when the collectivity of states agree. The climate regime has tried to square this collective action circle for years. This is actually 20 years into the climate regime. They're still looking pretty optimistic. A lot of the time it was like that because there is difficult political and economic issues that are also part of this challenge. But I would suggest that the consent dynamics take center stage, and also actually coming to terms with them and working around them is key to explaining how we ended up with this, at least at the time, very joyful moment. Now, as you all know, multilateral treaty making is typically, the process is highly formalized. We've already heard about this. States adopt the text, which marks the end of the negotiations and the fixing of the terms of the instrument. Then the treaty tends to be open in the case of multilateral treaties for signature for a specified period of time. And finally, once states submit their instruments of ratification or accession or whatever it is, they express their consent to be bound by the terms of the treaty. And at each of these stages in the treaty-making process, these individual acts also have a collective dimension. So first of all, the negotiating states collectively have to agree to adopt the text. Second, I would suggest that even the individual signatures have a collective function because they signal to others support, who supports, how much momentum is there, and so on. And then finally, of course, unless the stipulated number of parties ratify, the treaty will not enter into force. Now, ideally, this interplay between individual and collective aspects of the process creates a foundation for a viable treaty. But in the context of a challenge like climate change, an urgent challenge, this intertwining of the individual and the collective also has a darker side because it can slow the progress toward more ambitious requirements, or it can even result in a standstill. And so overall, international environmental law has actually been reasonably successful in supporting collective action. There are hundreds of multilateral environmental agreements that have been negotiated dealing with regional and global issues. And states have come up with a range of approaches to alleviating this challenge of getting to consent. One approach is the framework protocol model of treaty design, and that's premised on incremental development of commitments over time. And it has shown itself to be conducive to promoting state consent to collective action. Why? Because the initial threshold is relatively low. The first step at the framework treaty is to agree what is the common concern, what's the objective. There are some basic principles, there are some basic commitments, there are typically procedural obligations that are designed to get the parties to share information and engage, and then for our purposes, importantly, there are rules and institutions for decision-making and subsequent treaty development. So this is ALET again, the treaty conclusion of the treaty is just the beginning. And then supplementary treaties, and they're often called protocols, they allow, again, for a number of things that might make consent easier. One option is you have several of them and you break the problem down into bits. That is, you have one pollutant in protocol A, another one in B, another one in C, and parties can then decide that they do some of these, but not all of these. If you bundled them all together, it would be a lot harder to get agreement. Or you may have a protocol that is simply designed to allow states to delay agreement to more ambitious commitments until the ground is prepared. So in addition to this model, of course, these agreements have a number of approaches to facilitating collective standard setting. And these processes deviate from the very formal model that I had on the screen a moment ago. But in climate change, especially the agreements about appropriate burden sharing between North and South have exceeded the capacity of previously quite successful approaches to facilitating collective action. And so since its inception, the climate regime has wrestled precisely with the challenge of reconciling starkly different positions, and again, hat tip to Samantha and I think your 2016 article, actually managing disagreement as well. And so the climate regime is a very useful example for exploring what the different options are because it actually utilizes a whole range of modes of consent, many of which have already been mentioned. So there's formal consent to component treaties of the regime. There's something I'm calling simplified consent. I'll return to that. There is standard setting by plenary bodies. And there is all kinds of recourse to non-binding commitments, especially in the Paris Agreement. And for our purposes of interest is a device that the Paris Agreement introduced, referred to as nationally determined contributions. So what the Paris Agreement does is it obligates parties to make such contributions, but it doesn't determine their content. It doesn't make them legally binding at the international level. These contributions are decided upon at the national level. And so I'm interested in exploring the interplay between the individual and collective dimensions. Pinning that down is a fairly technical exercise, I realized, as I went through it, and I imagined eyes glazing over in the room to the extent that I can see them, because mercifully you are dimmed from standing up here. But that's part of the reason for the PowerPoint, to try to illustrate that, to give you some of the highlights. And my ultimate argument is that the Paris Agreement's approach in the context of our exploration here is not so much a shift away from consent, but a shift away from anchoring consent, individual consent, in a treaty-based collective lawmaking process. So let's go to the Framework Convention on Climate Change. So it was adopted in 1992, and it, in its initial path into being, followed the formal process that I've already outlined, that is adoption, signature, ratification, and this actually went relatively well. The convention garnered the 50 ratifications it needed in less than 2 years. And all told, I would say the convention has succeeded in creating a lasting framework for cooperation, but also for managing disagreement with 196 states and the EU parties to this treaty. Now, because the point of the convention was to facilitate precisely such long-term interaction, it established a plenary body, a conference of the parties, and decided that this would be the forum where regular, not just regular interaction between parties, but also for the negotiation and adoption of all key decisions in the regime, including decisions related to further treaty commitments, regime development. One option, needless to say, includes amendments to the convention. The amendment process tracks the formal process I've already described, except the signature step is dispensed with. Now, from the vantage point of regime development, this process nonetheless poses a number of challenges. First of all, parties have to opt in, if you will, to the amendment through formal consent. But even for those parties that do, and I should add, there is a very high threshold in the agreement. Three quarters of all the parties to the convention have to ratify. That's 148 states for an amendment to enter into force. And then, and this already came up, it's binding only on those states that opt in. So it's not possible through an amendment to ensure that binding ambitious commitments are imposed or are there that apply to everyone. Now, there is another significant hurdle, though, and that is not obvious from the text of the climate regime. And that is, we said that states have to agree to adopt the text of the amendment. Well, this is a quirk and a flaw at the heart of a lot of the challenges of the climate regime. The Conference of the Parties was supposed to adopt its rules of procedure at the very beginning of the regime, including rules on decision making, but the parties could not agree on a voting rule. So ever since the regime came into being, they've applied the rules of procedures provisionally, minus the voting rule, and instead the parties have operated on the basis of a general agreement that decisions are taken by consensus. And that means, in some sense, we can explore this in the discussion, only an explicit objection will break consensus, and so one could say consent of everybody else is presumed, or perhaps it's tacit consent. But it means also that individual states or a small group of states can effectively veto progress. And in the practice of the regime, breaking of consensus has only occurred on a handful of occasions, but the specter of this is always there, and it often prevents ambitious decisions from being put forward because everybody knows they have no chance, or it prompts compromises at the lower level. And so it's important to appreciate that this consensus practice has hobbled all available approaches to treaty development in the climate regime. And that means, in this case specifically, that treaty development through amendment can be hamstrung right at the outset because of the consensus problem, or then the other collective dimension is the entry into force formula. If it passes that hurdle, then there is still another hurdle to scale. So then the treaty provides for what I'm calling here simplified consent. I'm open to better suggestions. So for certain types of amendment or treaty development, that is specifically the adoption of so-called annexes or the amendment of these annexes to the convention, these are parts of the treaty that are typically reserved for more technical, descriptive, administrative matters, so not as high politics, if you will. So here the convention stipulates that a modified process, they have to be adopted in the usual way, meaning by consensus, But then amendments, annexes or amendments to them enter into force for all parties except those that provide written notification, so that opt out in writing. In other words, then it is a process that it deviates from the standard opt-in process to create what's generally called an opt-out process. So in the case of the former, explicit consent by a specified number of states is needed for the consenting states to be bound. In the case of the latter, there isn't a threshold, and consent is presumed, I'm suggesting, or maybe it's tacit, unless a party explicitly declines. And yet in the climate regime, even the apparently anodyne terms of these annexes are often so political that the consensus practice has made their adoption impossible, and there are some examples in the written paper. That brings me to standard setting by simple COP decisions, so plenary bodies. Both amendments and supplemental treaties, of course, are adopted by consensus in the conference of the parties, but then each individual party has a subsequent decision point, either explicit consent either, or opting out, or refraining from opting out, rather. So that there is this additional step before the terms become binding on individual states. By contrast, when the treaty empowers the conference of the parties to adopt a decision, these decisions take effect for all parties without any subsequent formal consent by individual states. Now, of course, generally speaking, the resulting standards are not legally binding. But in the practice of the regime, such formally non-binding decisions often have mandatory language in them and have very significant practical effects. And then the slow evolution of the climate regime also illustrates that even this formally binding standard setting is subject to exceedingly difficult negotiations, and given, again, the consensus practice, even these non-binding decisions can be difficult to adopt. Still, in principle, when we think about this from the perspective of this individual collective dynamic, in principle, this could be faster because it doesn't involve subsequent ratification or something of that nature. And the other thing that is really important for the object of this kind of treaty, that is collective action, it generates standards that are applicable to all. Now, let's move to the Kyoto Protocol. The first big step in the evolution was the adoption of this supplementary treaty. I will limit myself to a few points. The first one is that the protocol had great trouble entering into force. And that was because it contained a range of elements like emissions trading, a compliance regime, reporting requirements, and so on, that the parties provided for in the treaty, but then said the conference of the parties has to now develop detailed standards that allow us to actually do all of this. And so second problem was that while the protocol was open to ratification, signature and ratification by all of the convention parties, it was designed so that only industrialized states would have binding emission targets under them. And that necessitated a tailor-made entry into force formula, because of course the protocol wouldn't have practical impact if 100 states that I'm not going to have obligations, ratify it. And similarly, those states that would have obligations want to be assured that other major emitters do likewise. And so that led to the so-called double trigger formula, that you have 55 industrialized countries have to be among the states that ratify, and they have to account for a certain share of emissions. And that then created another problem, because the United States, accounting for 30% of emissions, decided that it wouldn't ratify the protocol, which meant that every single other industrialized country that would have had obligations under the protocol had to ratify before it could enter into force, which eventually did happen, but all of that was delayed because the package of decisions to provide all the details also took a long time to arrive at consensus on. So that's only the beginning, though. The problem for that really crystallized, that the Kyoto Protocol crystallized, was what do we do next? Because another feature of this protocol was that it had commitments for only 5 years. So what comes after? And here then the political dynamics came into being. Developing countries said, well, this is the right approach, differentiation. You industrialized states should have the binding commitments, we'll do what we can. And industrialized states says that can continue because some developing countries are now major emitters, so we will not continue with this unless everybody is part of it. And so parties were now confronted with this burden-sharing challenge head-on, and also with the problems that we've already that I've already suggested. That is, how do we add new commitments into this regime through an amendment? And what does an amendment require? All of the things that you see on the screen. And so that basically meant that the Kyoto Protocol ended up being what Jos Povelin and others have described as structures becoming shackles, that it became impossible to square this political circle because of the deeply entrenched positions. That brings us to the Paris Agreement. So like the Kyoto Protocol, the Paris Agreement is under the umbrella of the Climate Convention. It's kind of like a protocol, but for political reasons, they called it something else. Recourse to a new treaty actually allowed the parties to do something that is often said doesn't happen in path dependency. They thought of a new approach. And that new approach in the Paris Agreement actually enabled this agreement to be applicable to all convention parties, developed and developing. Briefly put, what the Paris Agreement requires states to do is to progressively undertake more ambitious efforts to ensure that global temperature increases don't go above an agreed threshold. But as I alluded to at the outset, states' individual contributions to global climate action are nationally determined, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So from the vantage point of consent, if you look at the Paris Agreement, you will see that it actually contains all of the things that I've already described, and in those modes of consent brings in all of the individual collective dynamics and the challenges of the collective dynamics, which is every single thing that I have here on the board requires consensus, and some of them require ratification or either through explicit consent or this opting out mechanism. And so that is one of the big reasons why the Paris Agreement introduced this new device, the nationally determined contributions. Before I go there, I want to say, I'm not saying that this formal process can't work. It actually did work. Right? The Paris Agreement was signed by, I believe, 175 parties to the convention on the day it was open for signature, and it entered into force in less than a year. There were lots of political reasons for that, some of them having to do with US politics and pending elections, but I won't go into that here. But the other reason, of course, is that the Paris Agreement was structured in a way that once again lowered the entry threshold in a certain way and allowed parties to do that. So what are these NDCs? The big difference in approach to the Kyoto targets here and the Paris, or between, the difference between the Kyoto targets and the Paris Agreement's nationally determined contributions is that compliance with the former was owed to the other protocol parties. They were enshrined in the treaty, they were legally binding under the treaty, whereas the Paris Agreement limits itself to obligating the parties to prepare, communicate, and maintain successive nationally determined contributions. They themselves, what states do, is not binding under international law. But also, because the decisions are made at the domestic level, these nationally determined contributions bypass the delays and blockages that can result from both a formal amendment process and the consensus practice, because individual parties, for example, can unilaterally make more ambitious commitments, equally non-binding, but they can progress. There are actually non-binding normative expectations in the regime, not just that parties have successive contributions, but that they will also be progressively more ambitious over time. Now, for our purposes, I think the key is that this is yet another variation on consent in the climate regime, because states do consent to climate action. But they do that not in the context of an international process and with international effect, but entirely through their respective domestic processes. And that brings me to a few conclusions. So, given the challenges of navigating the individual and collective dimensions of the consent process, it's perhaps a miracle that the original climate convention came into being at all. But as I tried to suggest, as a framework convention, it entailed relatively limited commitments. In some ways, it was consent to the ensuing social process. Reference was made this morning to Ellen Hayes. I think it was Christian Tams who made reference to Ellen Hayes' phrasing. I think that's exactly right. When you contrast that with the Kyoto Protocol, here now progressing towards more ambitious commitments in a consent-based system is a puzzle, maybe an unsolvable one, because arriving at ambitious terms to all parties is probably impossible, given these interconnected individual and collective aspects, and arriving at any commitments is very difficult because you will need a sufficient number of parties to be willing to adopt the new terms and then to bind themselves to them. I would suggest that given the starkly different circumstances and in the outlooks and priorities in the climate regime, these individual and collective dynamics of formal consent processes mean that they're not especially well suited to the development of a global greenhouse gas reduction regime, let alone an ambitious one, or one that could increase ambition rapidly enough to keep pace with the accelerating climate crisis. And then you add the quirk of the regime, the consensus practice, that presents an additional hurdle that complicates the adoption of amendments, supplementary treaties, and even the adoption of non-binding decisions of the parties. The Paris Agreement was, in part, intended to transcend the previous approaches, and the design, in some ways, might be a paradox, right? On the one hand, it entails that formal consent plays a much more limited role in treaty development. On the other hand, nationally determined contributions, by definition, leave individual parties almost entirely in control. So I would suggest that the Paris Agreement doesn't just entail a turn to informality. It does that too, of course. And that's, I think, aligns with Nico Krisch's observations in his 2014 AGIL article. It results in a bypassing of some of the strictures of formal international law, but it does not bypass, the turn to informality on its own does not bypass consensus. And that's why I suggest that the most important aspect of the agreement's often referred to bottom-up approach isn't so much the move away from formal state consent, but its location at the national level. The result is a shift away from the anchoring of individual consent and treaty-based lawmaking process, and so from the linkages that adoption and entry into force requirements establish between multiple parties' individual acts of consent. In other words, while perhaps not completely so, this nationally determined contributions approach disentangles the individual and collective dimensions of consent to climate action. So, in closing, I would say a couple of other observations in light of what I heard this morning. This structure of the regime and the consent process may actually also respond to the need for democratic legitimacy of international commitments, because it asks national decision-making processes to unfold in light of the international commitments. And that here, I mean the temperature targets that the agreement prescribes, that everyone agrees with, but also the normative expectations, greatest possible ambition, progression over time, and so on. So it's not just that you can do anything. There has to be some effort to be in line with the international regime. So it may be an interesting way to acknowledge the importance of domestic decision-making. It may also help resolve the tension between national political self-determination and deferring to international authority, what was highlighted by David Lefkowitz earlier, because Paris leaves states to decide, but it demands regard for the global goal and the global normative expectations. Well, whether locating the consent process at the national level and so freeing individual consent from the shackles of the collective process that attaches to consent to formal international law, whether that enables the completion of the global climate action puzzle, that remains to be seen, but I think it raises all kinds of interesting questions. Thank you.